Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Whatever is going on in the world, you can bet that humorist, author, columnist, and feminist scholar Gina Barreca has a take on it. Gina is an English professor at the University of Connecticut, and she has written several books on how she sees the world. Her latest, titled It's Not That I'm Bitter. She also shares a regular column in the Hartford Courant. She's with us today for a post-election pre-holiday chat. Gina, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me. Be part of the conversation.
Presumptive House Speaker John Boehner has ordered equal access to bathrooms for female members of Congress. So I think, forget political parties, but that made me wonder about Nancy Pelosi. Could a woman not risk making such an order? What's the deal with that?
Well, because it would have been, you know, had she done it, it would have been the biggest story, like, for months. And there would have been, you know, men protesting outside, and it would have been sort of what she was remembered for.
An abuse of power discussion,
exactly,
right?
Right, exactly. An abuse of power, as if, you know, the big joke is, I mean, what woman wants to have equal access to the men's room? I mean, if men are still using it. The whole business, you know, how the ERA, remember when we were all fighting for the Equal Rights Amendment back, you know, when the Earth's crust was cooling,
mm-hmm.
right? And the big argument that they used to persuade perhaps less informed women about voting against the Equal Rights Amendment, you know, equal pay for equal work and all the rest of it, they said you're going to have to share bathrooms with men. That was enough. They said it was going to be unibathrooms, and women who hadn't voted, you know, since the suffragettes got the right for women to go to the polls, said, this I'm never going to do, because it's terrifying. Women are terrified of using the men's room. And yet the equal access stuff really is important, because as we all know, you and I were talking before the show started, that women have spent, I don't know what, you think a third of our lives waiting
mm-hmm.
outside the ladies' room at major events because there were never enough
bathrooms. Yeah, who designed those venues?
I men, clearly. I think that's the short answer. And for this one, that somehow women also, I mean, we go there. The bathroom is a haven for us. It's a sanctuary. It's, you know, what the meeting rooms used to be in
yeah.
small communities. You walk into a bathroom, and there will be women laughing. First of all, there is always laughter coming out of the ladies' room.
Mm-hmm.
You ever notice that?
Mm-hmm.
There is rarely laughter coming out of the men's room. And actually, when there is laughter coming out of the men's room, we should worry. You know? I mean, they don't have separate stalls. And because women are in the ladies' room, and we're sort of we're telling stories about ourselves. If there is a woman in the bathroom, she is telling her life story to another woman who she's never met before.
Yeah.
But she's, you know.
But she just passed her the toilet paper under the stall door,
right,
so they're
exactly.
friends forever.
Or, you know, if there's no toilet paper, you see women going to each other, do you have two fives for a ten? You know, because, I mean, we're really, you know, there's never, we're needy people. This is what we have to do. And so, no, I think that had Nancy Pelosi done this, it would have been, you know, like the first item on her Wikipedia entry was that she had done this. It would have been how she went down through history. And so it doesn't surprise me, but it reminds me of when, you know, one of the books that I did was called Babes in Boyland, and it was about being one of the first classes of women at Dartmouth College, right,
mm-hmm.
back in the 70s. And one of the big issues that any institution that had been formerly all male, which is basically every institution,
mm-hmm.
They had to deal with putting in women's bathrooms. And apparently this was like one of the most traumatic things that they had to do. They were just like, we can't let women, I mean, the argument for some of the trustees were, we can't let women in to this Ivy League school because we don't have restroom facilities. You know, I mean, this has kept women out of places. And you're going, well, you know, you've built other things. You know, you put in indoor lights. Even though for a while there were no indoor lights, you know, there were no, like, electricity, you manage that. So probably there are other ways that you could make this happen. And so, yeah, it doesn't surprise me, although it disappoints me, that it took a Republican man to do this. But, you know, it's this whole bipartisanship thing,
mm-hmm.
And we let anything that makes a difference, that's fine. As long as what I, you know, my fear is that that means that people are going to lock the women into the ladies' room from the outside when certain votes are being taken. You know, I mean, that would just be another way of rigging the election. So.
Well, you know, it makes you wonder, though, that what if there was equal access to Congress?
Yeah, right.
It's still, you know, not that there's not access. Anybody can run for Congress
right,
who wants
exactly.
to, but it's clear that there's something.
Yeah, the precedents are not really.
The numbers are.
I think,
was it 77 precedent. Women, I think, serve?
Right.
Something
I mean, if
like that,
that, actually, I don't even know if the number went down. But
ridiculous.
It's, yeah, yeah. So it's still, we got, we still have bigger worries than access to the facilities. But, you know, anything that works, works. And anything right. that gets us talking about women in politics, even if it's sort of something backwards that you can't say on the air, that seems to me to be a sort of a legitimate concern. Yeah. And it's not the niceties of it. It's just the access to it.
My guest is Gina Barreca. She's author of It's Not That I'm Bitter, among many other books. She is an English professor at the University of Connecticut and a columnist for the Hartford Current. If you have a question or comment for Gina, want to join the conversation, you're welcome. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or I'm at @AnnFisherWOSU on Twitter, and we are on Facebook as well. So join the conversation in any way that fits your personality. You share a column in the Hartford Current. The last time we talked, I don't think that was active at the time with Larry Cohen.
Oh yeah, we do it every week, but okay. There may have been, but yes, for a long time I've been doing this Sunday column, and again, they can come onto my website, which is GinaBarreca.com, or the Hartford Current website. But with Larry Cohen, who is a conservative man, and we go back and forth every week. And so, for example, we discuss, you know, basically this week's conversation, for example, was an interesting one. And it was on whether or not the news can ever be objective, you know. And my argument was that even when I started, when I went from my first attempt at getting a job in the media, as they say, I went for a news writing job at WCBS Radio in New York, you know, where they give you the news in 15 seconds and then you get, you know, car ads. And the news was in those days, this was like 1982, I mean, it was coming over the wire. And I really think there was like a guy with a tin can, you know, outside the building, like saying the news. I mean, this was a long time ago. But the information, I think, was something like, and so this was to get the job. Basically, this was, you know, part of the interview process. So I had to write what would be a story based on what was coming in over the wire. And it was something like, you know, 23 people killed in a pileup accident in Texas. And I thought, okay, now how do I do that? Is it 23 people killed? Is it tragedy in Texas? Is it, you know, don't be afraid to fly? You know, what's the right that you have to couch even the most basic fact in language, and language is always going to have a bias. You know, that there's
yes.
no, in a way, there's no such thing as objectivity. We can just kid ourselves.
Not unless you live in a vacuum. I mean.
Right. And even that, I mean, do you live in a vacuum or do you live where there's nothing? I mean, even the word vacuum is silly.
It implies some. In fact, I had an editor who didn't like the word accident. There is no such thing as an accident. He wanted car crash.
Oh, really? There's no such thing as, was he like a Freudian or something?
He just thought that there's always a reason why it happened. Somebody didn't put their foot on the brake. Somebody didn't have their brakes checked. Somebody, you know, there's always something.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Someone was following the person too closely in the fog, blah,
right,
blah, blah.
Right, but you can't call it an intentional.
No,
you know? I mean,
well, that's
really, you know,
yeah.
Yeah, that's really, that's, I'm okay, I'm going to do a blog just on that. That's really an interesting.
What's an accident? Define
and
an accident.
Counts, if there's something that's an accident, I mean, in your emotional life, you know, maybe not, but I think on a highway that, you know, the definition of accident, but yeah, so every editor has has an approach. Every writer has an approach. And so we take ideas and sort of play with them. Now, as I did with the columns that I do with Gene Weingarten in the Washington Post, Weingarten and I wrote a book together called I'm With Stupid, One Man and One Woman and 10,000 Years of Misunderstanding Between the Sexes Cleared Right Up. And that's still around in paperback. And Gene Weingarten, people might know, as he won his second Pulitzer Prize last year. Not that I'm bitter, but he won a second Pulitzer Prize. Why do you think I called the book that? And people might know him because he was the one who did the story about putting Joshua Bell, the great violinist, in the metro station in Washington.
Subway, right.
Right, and having him play for free and then watching people on a video camera, you know, who stopped to listen.
That was a great story.
It was a great story. And that was Weingarten's story. Weingarten wrote that as a feature. And so Weingarten and I, we wrote this book and we did those columns without ever meeting. We did them over the phone and over email. And with Larry Cohen, I met him once because the Hartford Courant wanted us to have our picture taken. But basically, Larry, like, ran away from me. He was like a feral cat or something. I mean, I was, like, opening the can of, you know, chicken, but he wasn't coming near me. And finally, like, I grabbed him by the suit jacket and said, we have to stand next to each other for the photograph. But he still then ran away. We do these, again, just over email, and it makes it sort of fair, you know, because we really don't know each other.
So there's not a personal attachment.
Right, right.
Let me ask you this. Why does he always get to start it? Is it because you get to finish it?
Yes. Okay. I like having the last laugh. That's been my sort of motivation and my ambition in life is to get the last laugh. And I enjoy being able to play with whatever he throws out there. And it's sort of like he's the straight man in some way. I mean, I enjoy sort of looking at his ideas and then, you know, and then volleying them back to him. And so it makes it more entertaining for me. And that way I really do get the little final coda. And I enjoy that. That's something that I get a kick out of. And this way I can, and it's also because there's a little bit of control freak in me. This way I get to send it to the editors. They get back to me and say they received it. You know, I can say, okay, that's done. And then, you know, scratch it off my to-do list and get on to the next thing.
Who gets to pick the topic?
Usually he does.
Okay.
Usually, yeah, he comes up with it. Every once in a while, there'll be something that absolutely captures my attention that I say, we need to do this. But often, and sometimes the editor, Carolyn Lumsden, will say, come on, guys, this is happening now. We need to address it. But often it'll be, you know, he'll come up with two or three starters, and you know, I'll get to pick. It's like picking, you know, the number out of a hat in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll begin. But it's really interesting because they're fun, and people do read them from around the country because now there is the fabulous elegance of, like you said, Facebook or whatever. People can just go on, and I'm on Facebook, and it is fun to see how people respond. And I did one on, you know, why is it that women feel like we're fat if we can't fit into the jeans we wore in high school, and men feel that they're fat if they can't fit into a foreign car. You know, like there's this discrepancy
You had a fun discourse about the body image thing.
Yeah, the body image thing. And you know, women really responded to that. Men are still going, huh? You know, they really still don't get it. And it's really and it is interesting because it's, you know, obviously it, to a certain extent, it's playing off stereotypes. But to another, you know, to another big important way, it's a relief to know that it is ubiquitous. We're not the only ones. There's still this sense of women's lives not being represented as they really are. You know, I read People magazine or, you know, Elle or whatever, and, you know, we're looking at Julia Roberts and Eat, Pray, Love, and I'm thinking, this woman doesn't eat. You know, here's a movie about food, and I eat. And I look like I eat. And most people who eat look like they eat. You know, the people who are doing Eat, Pray, Love, no. If I ate like that, I would have to pray a lot more to look like Julia Roberts. You know? There would be a lot more prayer like, oh, please, God.
It's the movies.
Let me not have eaten that much couscous. You know? That would be.
We have to take a quick break. My guest is Gina Baraka, author of It's Not That I'm Bitter and many other books. We'll be right back. If you want to join us, 614-292-8513. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
everybody's an expert on their own lives. And on Talk of the Nation, we ask you to share your stories.
These techniques were used on me when I went through resistance training, sleep deprivation, putting bags over our heads.
I'm Neil Conan. Real stories from real people about real issues that matter to you. Join us. Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation from 2 until 4 right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. 21 degrees in downtown Columbus. Clouds today with scattered snow showers and a high of 25 degrees. Less than half an inch of snow is expected today. Scattered snow showers tonight, cloudy, and a low around 19 degrees, but little or no accumulation overnight. For Tuesday, light snow showers, cloudy skies, and a high of 23. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides. My guest is Gina Barreca, humorist, author, feminist scholar, and teacher. If you'd like to give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, Gina, a recent column you did about the new TSA body search rules. You really caught some flack over that.
I really did. But, you know, that's when you come up with a novel idea that has an impact in a lot of different areas, you know, people are bound to get upset. What I argued in the column was that the TSA, first of all, you know, with the new pat-down rules mm-hmm. and the new sort of screening devices that they have, that it seemed to me mostly men being driven to hysteria over these new security measures, that I thought, you know, women are used to these indignities at this point. When women go for any kind of medical examination, at some point, some nurse is going to walk into the room basically with jumper cables and say, just relax, you know? I mean, we're used to anybody walking in with any kind of device, you know, and saying, just relax. And women are going, okay.
It's going to be feel a little cold.
It's going to be, right, it might be a little cold, exactly. You know, this might be uncomfortable for a moment. It might pinch. And we're just like, okay, go ahead. You know, what are we going to do? This is going to be it. You know, women, it's like when men show parts of their anatomy photocopied at Christmas parties and, like, that's supposed to be funny. Women don't do that because a lot of us get mammograms. You know, and if part of us is going to be photocopied, you know, Blue Cross is paying for half. And this is what I decided, that what the TSA should do would be to offer screenings, you know, real health screenings as we go through these machines that give somebody a mammogram, the men could get their prostates checked. Small children could be checked for cavities. You know, I mean, let's make use of the time here. You know, why make it such a big deal? Just bring in, you know, something that would make us actually, the America would be a stronger, healthier, safer nation if everybody got these screenings. And also I thought, you know, it, just in case people were, you know, didn't feel that they were getting enough, nervous enough by everything, this way they could also feel that it was part of the Obama universal health care and they could get really upset by that too. So, you know, this would just let everybody, you know, get nervous just about one thing. I mean, I hate to fly. I am terrified of flying.
I was going to ask you if you travel much.
I travel a lot, and I am terrified of flying.
Really?
I really, it is, you know, I'm a recovering Catholic, as I talk about, and it's not that I'm bitter, because I'm 53, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so when I was growing up, the Catholic Church in Brooklyn, in an Italian family, the Catholic Church had one lesson for girls. And that was to remember that sex was something dirty and disgusting that you save for someone you love. Right? And, you know, 27 years of therapy has helped. I mean, it has. I won't say it, you know, it hasn't kicked in.
That's really interesting. I've never actually thought about it quite way, Gina.
Yeah, I tried to put it in the clearest possible lesson.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to think people have said, you know, the church has changed and it's more forgiving and you don't, but I just remember, You know, after ninth grade, I thought, okay, this is really not going to work for me. And so I decided, you know, so the whole recovering Catholic thing. But again, since even as Erica Zhang said, there were no atheists on airplanes, you know, I would get on and I would try to be remembering like the act of contrition, and I would realize that I'd be saying like the Pledge of Allegiance, you know. And so I do fly all the time, though, because I don't think it's fair for me to get up in front of groups. In fact, I'm speaking at a town hall in Dayton in the spring, and get up in front of groups of people and young people that I teach, or groups of women, and say it's important to face and conquer your fears, and you have to take risks. But me, I'm taking the bus. You know, I thought that lacked integrity. So I face my fears and I get on the planes. And I got to say, you know what? I am really happy when the security measures are good. People argue that that's for ritual purposes. That's fine. I'll take ritual purposes. I'll take, you know, whatever they want to do to make me actually safer, to make me feel safer. I'm good with that. I'm really, I'll deal with it.
I'm still kind of bummed out about the shampoo stuff, but, you know.
I know.
Have you gone through any of the screenings, the x-ray machines and the pat-downs or any of that?
I haven't gone through the very new ones. Mm-hmm. I've gone through the ones, though, that blow air at you so you feel like Marilyn Monroe in The 7-Year Itch. Have you had that? They blow through different vents. Like all over your body.
No, I haven't.
It's like a weird sensation. And it's one of those things where you almost feel like, can I go through that again? You know, I'm not sure actually. Can we just try that again? I think I like it, but I'm not actually. And I'm not even sure with that. It makes your hair look a little funny. And you sort of are glad you're not wearing a miniskirt. But you'd have to be nuts to travel in a miniskirt anyway.
No kidding, yeah.
Yeah, it really. So that's fine. But no, I haven't gone through the new ones. But that's, you know what? That's okay. And I, you know, when I do, that'll be fine. And what's interesting, it's interesting you mentioned the shampoo, because here's one of my other arguments about women and men. Women will bring our shampoos to hotels and then take the little shampoos that they have and we'll bring them back. Okay. Now, how insane is that? Okay. We are transporting shampoos around the nation and then getting upset that we might not be able to, like, do the shampoo transference as much as we've done it before. We will bring our own shampoo, then take the shampoo back from whence we came.
Do you think it's a coincidence that the ounce limitations are exactly what you get in the hotels?
Well, I think that now hotels are making them bigger. Because now they know you can't take them. They're saving $1 billion. I think it was the hotels that hooked up with the TSA and said, let's save some money on this. This is another way to jumpstart the economy. Stop having women take body lotion that they're just going to end up trying to give to their niece as a present, you know, because it's really, you know, we never do anything with that anyway, and it dries out in the closet.
Well, now for those of us among us, you know, you can donate them. There are different places
to the
shelters and stuff.
And we posted that too. Yeah.
Yeah, so have I, and we have posted that website just in the last week, I think, for something.
Oh, good.
But we have Ralph waiting to talk to us. Let's put Ralph on the air. Well, Ralph, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. I like your guest attitude on the screenings. I think that's fun. Having gone through the screening, it's really nothing, and we've made way too big a deal out of it. But I don't, as a man, I don't resent women joining any of the clubs that I used to be a member of. And the only thing I resented was that they eliminated skinny dipping.
Now, was that a big loss for you, Ralph?
Yeah, well, it's a big deal. I mean, you know, it's a more comfortable way of swimming, and they eliminated it at OSU years ago because, you know, they had separate facilities, and now they have one much better facility, and I understand that completely, but you can't skinny dip anymore, and the athletic club has eliminated skinny dipping. I mean, you know, it's just the one thing that was kind of comfortable.
I have never heard that argument for somebody. That's actually a really sensible argument.
That's legit.
That is.
Well, they eliminated it in Congress, too. I think that's one of some of the Congress that are so, you know, difficult.
That just makes me feel so much better.
But what I need to do, Ralph, is now erase the image from my mind immediately. I need to delete the image of our elected members is skinny dipping, because that's too horrifying for me, personally.
Well, just, you know, they ought to go through the screening at the airport. That would be a terrorist act.
That'll be right. And they should be, yes, that'll be a whole new way to poll people. I just, very bad. But, yes, absolutely. But I think the skinny dipping argument is a new one, and I appreciate that. I'll figure out a way to work that into something, I'm sure.
Ralph, well, thank
luck.
You.
Thanks.
614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guest is Gina Barreca, author of It's Not That I'm Bitter and many other books. She is an English professor at the University of Connecticut and a columnist as well. So give us a call or email us if you want to join the conversation. In an article in Time magazine, a recent article, Gina, it said that women are less competitive than men in the job market. And that sort of dovetails on a conversation I was having last week regarding the wage disparity, the continuing wage disparity. I think it's 77 cents in the dollar now.
Right.
And I was wondering do you think women are less competitive, or what do you think's going on there with that?
Well, I think it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out, actually, as the economy, you know, tries to stable itself. It's sort of lurching, you know, from one side to the other. And I think that we're going to go back to the scary territoriality that was beginning slightly to get a little bit easier, where people weren't, you know, feeling like there wasn't enough to go around. I think now everybody's back to feeling like they need to cover, you know, their piece of earth, and they're not going to let anybody else onto it. And I think that in terms of being competitive, competitive was always a really interesting word for women, as was the idea of being ambitious. I remember the first time somebody called me ambitious was when I was in high school, and I took it as such an insult. I thought, if I'm ambitious, that means, like, I'll never be able to date. You know, I will never marry. I will never. An ambitious woman was a terrifying specter. It really was the antithesis of being feminine, I thought. And it wasn't until I was in my sort of mid-20s that I began to realize that, you know, it wasn't a bad thing. And that if you went up to a woman and said you're ambitious, and you went up to a man and said you're ambitious, that the man would absolutely take it as a compliment, where the woman, again, might shrink from the idea, and that the same would work with the idea of competitive. And I like to think that that's changed a little bit, but I still worry, because one of the things that I see happening with, I don't know if it's true as much as Ohio State or, you know, how regional it is. I suspect from the talks that I give that it's around the country. Where have you noticed that young women, even the ones who are going to be, like, running NASA and the American Medical Association, all speak like they're asking questions, even when they're making declarative statements, which makes even the really smart ones sound like morons. And part of that, I believe, really goes back to the idea that girls are still encouraged or you know, somehow supported in the belief that they're not supposed to know what they're saying. And that to assert your belief, to argue what you really believe is your point, to sound like you know what you're talking about, is considered unfeminine, is threatening, is somehow going to prevent you from being popular, you know, whatever the right term is, that it's somehow going to put you out of the sexual marketplace. And so it takes me months to encourage the young women in my classes not to speak like that, like they cannot answer a question with a question. I mean, not unless we're doing some kind of, you know, we're arguing in some sort of debate class sort of way, that they need to actually make a statement and that they can't apologize before they speak. That's the other thing that I see, and young men as well as young women doing that, that when I ask the question in my classes, which, you know, I have 40 kids in them or whatever, and I'll say, all right, what's going on page 396? And the hands will go up and they'll say, well, I just want to say that. or I don't know if this is right, but, mm-hmm. or I can, you know, maybe this is what, and there's some kind of caveat before they speak. And I tell them by the second week of class, you can't do that. You can't apologize. If you're going to say something stupid, own it, but don't apologize. And sometimes they have to do it silently to themselves at the beginning. So I'll say, all right, you know, Joan, what's going on? And she'll go, on page 73. And so she'll have done it. But you know what? That's better than walking in, because the reason that I learned this, and I think this goes back to the competitive question, is I had a friend of mine who's an editor in New York, and I had sent one very smart student to go down to interview for a job after she graduated. And my friend called and said, okay, you have to do better with training your student. And I said, okay, how come? And she said, this young woman walked in here, and obviously very accomplished, you know, Phi Beta Kappa, all the rest of it. And she walked in and said, for 15 minutes, she told me why she wasn't qualified for the job. Said, I don't know if I could really do this. You know, I'd really love to do this, but I'm not sure that I really could, you know, handle mm-hmm. everything, because this is really my first job, and it's such an important job, and I know the work that you do is so terrific, and I would really love to keep up, but I'm not sure I can. She was like, get out of here.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to somebody walking in and saying, I'm a quick learner. You know, give me what you got. I will keep up. I'll stay here as long as it takes to make it happen. I will do whatever you need me to do. I will make this work for you. And, you know, I'm going to meet every expectation you have. And we still, I think, in our culture, encourage boys to go in there with that kind of bravado, because that's what it is. It's that confidence.
Mm-hmm.
And that girls still lack. And what I worry is that in an effort to sort of level the playing field, it's not that we're giving girls more confidence, it's that we're taking confidence away from the boys. That's not what we want to do. You know, that's not how to level the playing field, is to make everybody feel, not that they just have some empty sense of self-esteem, but that they have an actually earned a sense of self-respect, that they do know that they can do something, that they are capable, you know, that they're confident for a reason. And, you know, that's what our schools need to do. It's not just a self-esteem business. We need to actually give them areas of competence and skill that they're absolutely assured of, because they do know how to do stuff.
You know that question in the job interview where they say, what do you think would be the most challenging aspect of this job for you? What do you, you know, where are you possibly the least prepared? And
right.
Some people can just go on and on and on with that, and they don't get it that you're supposed to say, well, I might have trouble with this, but I'm a fast learner.
Right, exactly. Right. They're going to say, oh, what are you kidding? Well, you know, my emotional issues, I'm a recovering Catholic. I mean, that's not the way to start,
yeah.
You know, and I really try to explain to them that this is not, you know, this is not, they really don't want. And this is what's hard, is that they don't want to be your friend. You know, your boss does not want to be your friend. Your boss may be friendly. Your boss may be nice and compassionate and, you know, interested in you. But your boss is there to be your boss. Your boss is there to work. And also, we're so used to now praising our young people and encouraging them since, you know, we played them baby Mozart or whatever in the womb.
Mm-hmm.
That I now have a lot of students, and I mean, I'm very lucky. I've been teaching at UConn for 23 years. I love my students. I keep in touch with a lot of them. They've become genuine friends over the years. But I would say, you know, for the first, like, 10 years that they're in the workplace, and this is increasingly the case, I'll get emails from kids, boys and girls, young men and young women, who will say, but I'm not getting, you know, I don't know how I'm doing. I don't know if I'm doing well. I'm not getting any praise. And I said, are you getting a paycheck? You getting your paycheck? And they say, yeah. I said, that's your praise. You know, that's it. Nobody's going to come and pat you on the back. Very few times are you going to hear good job. You know, I mean, unless you're in a really low paying, you know, environment, you know, unless you're working for a not-for-profit where your health care benefits are really poor, you know, and then people are going to need to, you know, bring you homemade risotto just to keep you there, you know. But if you're working for a real wage in a for-profit company, then your paycheck is your good job. And when they fire you, then you're going to know, or you get a poor performance report, you're going to know you're not doing well. But nobody's going to come and congratulate you for doing your job. And they don't get that. That's a big That's a big new realization.
Yeah, it's very recent. You know, we got to take another break. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with Gina Borecka, author of It's Not That I'm Bitter. If you want to join the conversation, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on WOSU 820 NPR News.
For as little as $60 per year, you can support WOSU and get some great benefits, too. With a basic membership, you receive the WOSU member card, good for discounts at more than 200 area restaurants and attractions. You'll also receive a complimentary one-year subscription to Newsweek magazine, and you'll automatically receive our electronic airfare program guide and our e-newsletter. To support the programs you love, sign up for your basic membership for just $60 a year. Visit WOSU.org and click Donate Now.
This is WOSU 820 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, join us for Hour 2 of All Sides and a conversation with Jimmy Wales, founder of Wikipedia. That discussion begins at 11. Hear more from our station anytime at WOSU.org. Listen to All Sides with Ann Fisher whenever you want with the online archive. Podcast Newman Archive shows from all the guests and topics. You can podcast All Sides at WOSU.org/allsides. And it's 21 degrees in downtown Columbus, clouds and a few snow showers today, a high of 25 degrees and about a half an inch of snow accumulation expected later today. Scattered snow showers tonight, cloudy and a low of 19 degrees. Some light snow for Tuesday and a high of 23. Looking ahead to Wednesday, mostly cloudy and a high of 25. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on to WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides. My guest is Gina Borecka. She is the author of It's Not That I'm Bitter, among many other books. She's also an English professor at the University of Connecticut. She's a columnist as well for the Hartford Courant. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I was thinking about Barbara Walters' Most Fascinating People of 2010. It's coming up, and apparently Sarah Palin's one of these. And I was wondering who you think are the most fascinating people.
Well, Sarah Palin would not be on my list, I have to say.
She doesn't.
Have you seen
Plumb the Depths of Your Curiosity?
I actually watched because I felt, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, I write for The Current, but I blog 3 times a week for the Chronicle of Higher Education, and mm-hmm. I write for Psychology Today, and I feel like I feel enormously privileged to be able to comment on, you know, as you and I, and I mean, to be able to look at the world and to get to sort of talk about it. What mm-hmm. a great privilege. So I like to, you know, look at those things that, even if they're not in my direct line of vision, you know, you have to sort of make yourself do it. And so I watched a couple of episodes of the Sarah Palin reality show.
My Alaska.
Mm-hmm. I got to say, I was not impressed. I mean, this was somebody who had all of the resources that she could have, you know, had at her disposal to make this woman has presence. You know, she's good looking. I mean, she's like a less good looking Tina Fey, you know, but she really is, you know, she's out there. She has charisma. She's able to do this. The show did not work just as a show. The show just didn't work. I mean, I was looking for something that would at least be engaging. And I was fast-forwarding through the parts in the boat. I mean, I'm fast-forwarding through the stuff. And it may be just because I don't go outside. I'm not an outdoor girl. I'm an indoor girl.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating would not be the thing that would come to mind for me. And I'm thinking, you know, who would I... The people that I find fascinating, sadly, in 2010 are probably the people that I found fascinating, like, in 2007. I'm still interested in what's going to happen, for example, I want to know who the next people are. I want to know who's going to replace Oprah Winfrey. Who's going to be the next big person on the scene in a way that Oprah has sort of controlled the tastes and interests and curiosities of her audience. You know, who's going to step into that role? That's going to be interesting to see what happens in the next year.
Do you have any predictions?
You know, I don't see anybody. I was thinking for a while it was going to be Joy Behar, who I think is a hoot, and I think who's very smart and funny. But I don't think that she's actually going to be able to do that. I don't think Ellen is going to be able. I mean, she's got a whole different demographic. I think mm-hmm. she's terrific. But I'm not seeing it. You know, I'm not really seeing it happen that way. I'm really not. And so I'm sort of doubtful that there's going to be somebody. I think there's going to be a real gap. And I think that's going to be interesting. And I think that the book publishers are really going to suffer for that.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's going to be fascinating to see how that also translates. I think that what's going to happen in terms of books, and I would love to know for your next guest, I heard you've got your Wikipedia guy coming
right.
on. How exciting is this? I'd like to know what he thinks the effect of Wikipedia has been on books. My students now, I have to smack them away from Wikipedia. I love Wikipedia. It's like having the Library of Alexandria at your fingertips. But they will now, before they read a novel I assign to them, they will go to Wikipedia to find out what it's about. Even kids who would not go to Cliff Notes or Spark Notes or E-Notes or who wouldn't read, you know, the plot synopsis in one of those other, you know, bad student guide places
mm-hmm.
because they know that that's like reading porn, you know, that it'll corrupt them, that that's not what to do. They will go onto Wikipedia and just get the overview. And I'm like, you can't do that. You know, you could do that after. You can find out what other people think, but you can't do it before. But they now have, you know, that's been around for long enough that they've been doing that since they've really been reading books.
Right.
And so that's been, you know, that's sort of a really interesting effect that it's having on the culture. And not only reflecting the culture, but shaping the culture.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what's interesting to me. It's like the mirror and the lamp thing. You know, what's really leading us, you know, to the next, you know, to the next place. I love the fact that we've got debates about civility that's really happening. I've gotten increasing numbers of people. I'm going to talk at Chautauqua, the
mm-hmm.
fabulous lecture series this summer, about the end of civility. And I was just on the Connecticut Forum about that. It was with David Gergen, Stephen Carter, who's a law professor and a novelist at Yale, and Christopher Buckley. And whether civility has sort of just, you know, whether it's going to be a lost commodity, whether it's going to be like, you know, little sort of doilies. Is it just a nicety that's going away, or is it a pillar of our culture that's being, you know, sort of undermined, and the whole foundation of the culture is going to, you know, is going to start to rock and is eventually going to come down if we take that away. And so, you know, I think that these are big questions, and they're interesting ones. But I think all of that's going to be, you know, all of that's really scary in light of what people's real lives, what's really happening.
Do you think, though, as far as who's going to replace Oprah, isn't it, you know, those kinds of people, aren't they almost, I don't want to use the word irreplaceable, but doesn't a vacuum have to be created for someone to fill it, that no one can just walk into her
right.
shadow, and even
right.
if it was her best friend, it
right.
would be
Gail King, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, and Gail King actually, you know, used to be an anchor in Hartford. I mean, I knew Gail King when, you know, she was here, and you know, and she's very smart, and I think she's you know, head of the magazine and does
yeah.
the radio station, and but no, it's a different, you know, Oprah has captured the imagination of the country in a way that very few people have. I
mm-hmm.
mean, she's evangelical that way,
mm-hmm.
and you know, a couple of false steps here and there, but, you know, for the most part has been a steady influence, and I think pretty much for the good, on you know, especially her female viewers, and given them a sense of strength and competence and all the rest. And I don't see anybody else really stepping up to that. The only person who I see who now actually whose ratings are better than Oprah is Judge Judy, is Judy Shineman. And now I happen to have an investment in Judge Judy because Judy Shineman, who then was, you know, Judy Blum was my next door neighbor in Brooklyn, New York. I grew up next door.
What, the author?
Judy, to Judge Judy.
Oh, Judy, okay.
Judy. And
wow.
And she's just, she was great about Judy. She was like the only girl on the block to go to college, you know. She was the dentist's daughter, so she came from an educated family where not everybody else on the block, you know, graduated from high school. And Judy is exactly who she is. I mean, she's you know, this tiny, tiny, fierce woman who was put, you know, was appointed to the Supreme Court and the Family Court of New York. I mean, she earned her right to be who she is. And she's exactly who she is. I mean, there's no difference between her as a person. I see her a couple of times a year. And it's just wonderful. So she has also captured the imagination. My students now have grown up watching Judge Judy. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, it's just a riot to see who is affecting them. And but what I miss, and obviously I think I'm sure your listeners do too, which is why they're your listeners, is I miss the fact that people aren't reading newspapers, that they're not getting news, you know, that they're not listening. People under 25, you know, aren't reading David Brooks.
You well, know, if they are, it's because someone Twittered it to them or somebody
right.
posted it on their Facebook. And you know, I've had a lot of conversations lately with people about, is it that we're consuming it. It's just we're consuming it in a different way. We're not picking up the newspaper in the morning. And, well, I am and my kid is, but most people aren't now. And that they're maybe getting the information, but does that change what you get out of it when you're reading it online or when you're reading it because someone, you know, Twittered it with a snarky remark to go with it or a sympathetic remark or
right.
whatever it might be?
Well, I guess my concern about that is that we're only reading things that we already know the content of.
Yeah.
When somebody, you know, when we go online or we look at particular venues. Now, you could say, well, you know, if you're picking up the Wall Street Journal versus the New York Times or, you know, Newsweek versus whatever, you know, The Economist, that you're already choosing your venue. But it's different because if you've got entertainment replacing news, if you really do have the results of, you know, LeBron, whatever, you know, the trade or whatever the teams are doing right next to whether, you know, jobs are being saved or lost or what's happening with the economy, what's happening with the Dow, what's happening with debts to China, and they seem to be weighted equally, then something's wrong, you know, and because there's not going to be the same impulse towards investigative journalism, that's obviously, I think, you know, the real fear is that those things are going to be lost. Now, I'm my investment in this as somebody who is a humorist is that I want to make sure that I get to write about stuff that I have a good time doing, but somebody else has to be out there really doing the hard work. Somebody has to be, you know, really making sure that the news is the news and that we're not just reading the first three lines of something, you know, that we're not just getting the headline. I mean, the headline is important, but the headline, as everybody who's ever worked in the media knows, is it's a tease. It's the ad for what it is as opposed to really what it is. So that we're getting just the taglines. We're getting just, you know, when you Google something, you write something in to a search engine that you know, if you just go for the first five things that appear, those are not necessarily going to give you the most sort of in-depth sort of profile of what it is you really need to know. And so it's so scattershot that it's unnerving. And that makes me, like, one of the pieces that I have in It's Not That I'm Bitter, and the subtitle to that is How I Stopped Worrying About Visible Panty Lines and Conquered the World, sort of an overview on what's happened to feminism in the last 20 years and, you know, how it became the F word and why my students at the University of Connecticut come up to me and say, but Professor Bereke, you don't look like a feminist. And what they mean is I'm not wearing a fedora and smoking a cigar, you know, because they think that there's a dress code if you're a feminist. And it means, you know, they think it means that you have to, you know, wear shoes that go down at the back or, you know, only eat soy or, you know, all of those are very nice things. But if there's not like a requirement, and I always tell them that, you know, if you're using cutlery and walking upright, you're probably evolved enough to be a feminist. And I assume that everybody I meet, men and women, are feminists. And so it's sort of like a little bit of a guide for young women about the fun parts of being a feminist. But I talk about how, you know, in terms of the news, how sort of issues that concern women have sort of been buried in terms of, you know, that it seems to be that feminism is not even in sort of a backlash anymore, but in sort of a whiplash, you know, that the stories are all just about victimization as opposed to about strength. And we need to make changes, but we need to make changes. And again, there's no such thing as objectivity, so we need to make changes in making sure we get wide sources of information in terms of the decisions we make and the opinions we listen to. And
I was thinking about when you were saying that if the LeBron trade is next to the, the floods and wherever they're happening today, that we're giving that equal emphasis. And I'm thinking, well, you know, in a lot of places, that's a lot more emphasis than it gets. I mean, I used to, when I was writing columns for the Dispatch, I would try to stick in the OSU Buckeyes every once in a while, just kind of randomly. And all of a sudden, my readership would, you know, do this big hit. I'd be getting a lot more hits from around the world because there's people that only plug into the Dispatch because of their Buckeye coverage. And he's like, you know, I don't have no pride. You know, do what I can to get.
Exactly. No, in fact, as you said that, I may put Buckeye in all my columns.
Whip in a little OSU Buckeye action there, and you're gonna see some amazing things happen. Gina, that's all the time we have. I hope you'll come back again.
Anytime you wish.
And if you're going to Dayton, you know, you could always, you know, drop into Columbus on your way there. And
actually, it would be a lot of fun to do it in person.
Okay. All right.
We could have a good time.
Well, we'll have to plan that. Thanks again.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
That's all the time we have for All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.